From Chicago Public Radio, this is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. According to a recent report from the U.S. Department of Justice, one in 37 adults in the United States either is now or has been in prison. Among non-whites, the rates are even higher. More than 1.5 million people are in prison now, and there are more than 4.5 million former inmates in the population. These numbers give some sense of how widespread the effects of incarceration might be for individuals. But prisons are also entities in the economy. They cost money to build and to run. They provide employment. And they affect the economic activity around them. In the last 2 decades, the United States has seen a huge boom in prison construction. Rural communities and small towns have been the site of most of the new building. In the 1990s alone, 245 new prisons were built in rural areas. Some states are now spending more on prisons than on higher education. How far-reaching are the economic consequences of the prison boom? Today on Odyssey, we're going to take a look at the political economy of the corrections industry. Joining us for the conversation is Tracy Hewling. She's a public policy analyst and a documentary filmmaker. She made the film Yes in My Backyard. Hello, Tracy Hewling. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. We're also joined today by sociologist and criminologist Paul Layton. Hello, Paul Layton. Thank you for joining the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Paul Layton, let me ask you to start with some background facts here. How much has the prison population grown in this period that we think of as the boom, roughly from 1980 onward?
Yeah, it actually started back in 1972, Richard Nixon and the Law and Order campaign. And since then, we've about quadrupled the prison population. If we include people in jail, we're now up to 2 million people incarcerated. If we include probation and parole, we have 5.6 million people under control of the criminal justice system.
So 4 times the number of people actually in prison than in 1972.
Yes.
Which I'm assuming is a much faster rate of growth than the population as a whole.
Yes, by far.
And how much are we spending on prisons each year?
Our best guess, which is a very low-end estimate, is $30 billion. That doesn't include a lot of the construction costs for new prisons, though.
So that's operating costs?
Yes.
And does that include both federal and state prisons?
Yes, it does.
Okay, Tracy Hewling, let's begin to talk a little bit about why we've had this growth. What sorts of factors have led to the growth in particular, prison construction? We may have to get there by way of other things, but how did we get to this situation where we have 245 new prisons being built in the 1990s?
Well, when you have a quadrupling of the prison population, you also need somewhere to put them. And so the pressure on states and the federal government and actually local counties to build prisons and jails increased exponentially during the 1980s and 1990s.
What sorts of factors led to this quadrupling? What sorts of, are there particular policies that we can point to that led to an increase in incarceration?
Well, most people will point immediately to the passage of very, very harsh mandatory minimum sentencing laws, which essentially remove judicial discretion from the sentencing process, and said that if you do this particular crime, the judge has no ability to consider extenuating circumstances. He or she must sentence you to prison.
Paul Layton, what other factors would you point to in contributing to this expansion in both the prison population and the number of prisons?
Certainly the mandatory sentences is an important one. The other part of this is the three strikes and you're out, this idea that you would go to prison for the rest of your life. So as where before you used to have a turnover of people cycling in and out of prison, you now have a much larger permanent population there at a cost of about $25,000 a year.
Okay, so we have both more people being incarcerated and people being incarcerated for longer, which is leading to this growth in population.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, let's begin to talk about how all of this expansion happens or affects the economy. Let's start at the level of the individual. Paul Layton, maybe you can help us here. I assume that anyone who's in prison is potentially a worker. I mean, you know, that seems like an alternative identity for someone who's in prison. What is the movement of all these people in and out of the prison system? What effect does that have on them as workers?
In general, we know that it's very detrimental, that being in prison takes you away from jobs, job skills, pro-social behavior that allows you to work well with others and do customer service. We know, especially in a time of 6% unemployment, that if you go there and you check off that little box that says you've been convicted of a crime, you're going to go to the bottom of the list. So generally, if you've been to prison, this is why we have such high recidivism and people going back again, is that it's hard to get a foot back out into the real world and get yourself established again.
Does it have any effect? Does the large population of people in prison have any effect on the labor pool outside of prison? In other words, it seems like one could come up with a scenario in which having a lot of people in prison eases pressure on the labor pool. So, you know, creating a more favorable market where there are fewer people competing for jobs.
That's certainly true. We don't count people in prison as being unemployed in the official labor statistics. So that kind of unemployment rate is artificially low because we don't count people in prison who are idle and most of them don't work. Certainly that does increase the availability of jobs for the other people out.
What about the particular communities that people are coming from? I mean, a lot of people who are incarcerated are coming from poor urban communities where jobs are not plentiful anyway. I mean, what's the likelihood that someone's going to be would have been unemployed anyway? I don't know how you would quantify that, but do you see what I mean? Like the likelihood that prison is an alternative to a productive working life.
Yeah, we know that a lot of people get into crime because they can't get legitimate jobs, so they make money dealing drugs, engaging in petty theft. We know that the lack of, it's called the stake in conformity that criminologists talk about, but not having that idea that you're going to college, your kids are going to college, you're going to pay off the mortgage, encourages a lot of people to get into kind of the underground economy and crimes. And there's kind of a chicken and the egg problem because a lot of the inner cities don't have factories and other types of jobs. So there's little for them to do but crime. And then you get engaged in crime, go to prison, come out worse, and you're even less fit to kind of become a member of the regular labor force again.
All right, Tracy Hewling, there's a flip side to this, which is that in some places where there are prisons, the inmates themselves are actually doing some work in those communities, well, doing work and sometimes in the communities around them. Do you know how common that is?
Yes, well, actually, most prisons that are in rural communities do contribute things like inmate work crews and they actually do work inside the prisons for a variety of different agencies within a community. It's actually one of the, if you want to call it, perks of having a prison in your community as perceived by local rural leaders. The problem with that is, and let's take an example out of my film for one, the problem with that is that the if you have an inmate work crew replace a roof on your hall instead of hiring local workers to do that, you are displacing low-wage workers in your own community.
Well, what's the range of types of work that prison crews do in these communities?
It's quite amazing the range of work they do. As I said, they can put roofs on town halls, they can blacktop driveways, they can paint government agencies, you know, the insides. They can do inside. They are doing printing jobs. They are making furniture. I mean, the gamut is very wide.
We're talking today on the program about the economic effects of prisons as entities in the economy. You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Paul Layton, so. There's this weird paradox where you have these people who go to prison and come out unemployable, but in the meantime, it may be that while they're in prison, they're actually doing work that's potentially displacing another worker. But overall, tell me who's interested in these questions of work around inmates and former inmates? Who's interested in whether prisoners are used as labor or the effects on employability of incarceration?
Yeah, there tend to be two big groups, one being business that would like to exploit prison labor, and the other being labor unions and other people who feel the economic threat. A lot of employers have realized that prison labor is, it's not always good quality, but it is very inexpensive. You can get away with paying someone much lower than minimum wage in prison. And a lot of companies that Tracy went through mentioned, there's also a lot of telemarketing that's done in prison. TWA actually has a reservation center in a Los Angeles prison, and they were excited because when there were the riots there following the Rodney King beating, it disrupted an awful lot of work, but the folks who were in prison just kind of went from one cell block to the telephones and went right back to work, and there was no loss of revenue, there's no downtime. So that was kind of a momentary burst of excitement and a shot in the arm for prison labor. But you also have more and more people being concerned about manufacturing jobs and other types of jobs going overseas to people who are getting paid low wages. And in lots of ways, the prison is kind of another example of that. It's almost a third world within the United States that these jobs are going to. And you have a lot of people frustrated because they kind of think, geez, do I have to rape somebody in order to get a job? You know, do I have to go out and commit burglary and sell drugs before I can get some job training and something that pays me a wage?
Well, what connection is there between the work that someone might do while they're incarcerated and their employability afterwards? Is there no transfer of these skills from one domain to the other?
There's a lot less than we'd think. A lot of times, if you work for a company within a prison, doing packaging for Microsoft or Eddie Bauer, Victoria's Secrets, both do some things in there. There's often not necessarily a place for you in the company when you get out. At other times, we find that we train people to do things that there's no counterpart for in the outside.
For example?
I got my graduate degree in D.C. and went up to Jessup, Maryland, where they're making license plates. And the only place in the entire state where they make license plates is in prison. So you can be a great license plate maker, but there's not necessarily a job for you doing that anywhere other than prison.
So to the extent that work gets done by inmates, is there any structured effort to translate that into post-incarceration employment?
There's very little. The federal government does a slightly better job than most of the states. There's a Unicor program that requires all federal inmates to have a job, and there's a little bit more transition there into jobs in the outside. But a lot of the prison jobs are kind of low wage, low skill. I mean, if you're cleaning up the community or something, there isn't quite a group that pays people to do that on the outside, so you really fall through the cracks once you're released.
All right, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation about prisons and the economy. We'll take a look at where the new prisons have been built and the kind of effects that prisons were expected to have and are actually having in the communities where they've been constructed. Stay with us. There's more to come. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you are listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. are listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Today on the program, we are talking about prison economics, looking at the economic effects of the boom in prison construction that's taken place over the last decade or two. Our guests for the conversation are Paul Layton. He joins us from Ypsilanti, Michigan, where he is a sociologist and criminologist at Eastern Michigan University. Paul Layton is the co-editor of the book Criminal Justice Ethics. Joining us from her office in New York is Tracy Hewling. She is the co-director of the National Resource Center on Prisons and Communities. She directed the documentary Yes in My Backyard, which examines the prison industry in rural New York. Tracy Hewling, okay, we've talked a bit about the economic consequences for individuals who may be incarcerated, but let's look a little more systemically, because prisons are sometimes sought after by communities in the expectation that they will bring economic benefits. Tell me a little bit about the kinds of places where prisons have been built.
Well, over the last decade in particular, when the prison population doubled, and we had an enormous expansion of prisons. Places in rural America that were where the economies essentially were collapsing. You know, West Texas Plains, the Mississippi Delta, the Appalachian region, South Central Georgia. Those places that were losing oil field jobs, farm work, manufacturing, textile factories, coal mining. All of those industries have left these areas. And so that is where we saw an enormous amount of prison construction over the last decade in particular.
And what do you think those communities expected from, what sort of economic effects did they expect from having a prison located in their community?
Well, what they're told is that prisons will provide, will create hundreds of jobs, and that they will have what they call secondary economic effects on the community. They will stimulate business. They will stimulate the spending in the economy.
And
that's the perception that, mm-hmm. that the average citizen in a rural community has when a prison comes to town.
And what actually happens? I mean, is there can you say systematically this is what really happens to the economy when a prison is located in a town?
Well, over the last few years, I would say the last 5 years, there's been a lot more research done looking at the effects of prisons on rural communities in particular. And I guess the conclusion I would reach from looking at that research is that the effects are wildly exaggerated. For example, you bring a 1,000-bed prison into a community, it creates approximately 400 jobs. That's a lot of jobs. The question for any community considering a prison is not how many jobs it creates, but how many do you get? And typically what we're finding is that only about 20% of new jobs created by a prison actually go to the people in the community where they pay the cost for the prison.
Who do the rest of the jobs go to?
People in surrounding areas or people transferring in from other prisons.
So people who have experience who are coming from other places.
Exactly.
But do they move into the community?
Over time, some of them do, although we haven't found a place yet that's recorded more than 40% of jobs in a particular prison going to residents of that community.
Paul Layton, do you think it matters where prisons are located? I mean, does the economic interest that a rural community might have in or think it has in getting a prison built in their town, does that jibe with or in any way conflict with the interest that the correctional system might have in corrections?
There is some questions kind of on an aggregate level. I should add before I get to that folks who are interested should read Tracy's chapter in a book called Invisible Punishment. It's edited by Mark Maurer of the Sentencing Project and Mita Chesney Lin, University of Hawaii. But the whole book is very good at examining lots of the hidden costs of prison building, and Tracy's chapter does a really good job going through the economics in particular. It's understandable for lots of rural areas to believe that the prison will help them out, although we know that the benefits aren't there nearly to the extent that they think it is. What we find is kind of an aggregation fallacy. this idea that if you leave an hour early, you can avoid the rush hour, and everyone leaving an hour early to avoid rush hour will kind of solve the problem. We know that doesn't work. And even if prisons helped an individual rural economy, trying to jumpstart a state by having lots of rural prisons ends up taking money from other things. So you end up in this kind of vicious cycle where you cut education and you cut crime prevention to try to build prisons. And that's non-sustainable and kind of irrational.
Well, but if a prison, if a state is pursuing policies that, you know, are leading to the incarceration of large numbers of people, they have to build prisons to put them somewhere.
Here's where you need to go back and look at how you make use of prison. We tend to believe that most of the people in prison are there for violent crimes, and that's not the case at all. The majority of people in the federal system are there for drug offenses, and a majority of people in state prison are there either because of drug or petty offenses. We need to take a hard look at this and say it's $25,000 a year to incarcerate somebody. We can send them to Harvard for that amount of money. Is it really worth putting this guy in prison for a little bit of crack and spending $25,000 a year on him? If we have to build a prison, it's about $125,000 a cell to build, and then some finance costs and bonds and other things on top of that. So the real question you need to ask is, who is really worth putting in prison when we're spending money like that, especially if it means cutting other programs to do it?
All right, but Tracy Hewling, that may well be true, but states are still incarcerating people. Does it matter, from your point of view, are there consequences to the fact that a great number of people do their time in rural communities, most likely away from the communities that they're from?
Consequences, well, there are two main consequences, I think. One is, to put the political back into the political economy of prisons, one of the consequences is that it is people, legislators who represent rural areas are very, very aware that prisons are one of the top three economic development engines in rural America right now. When those legislators also sit on committees in the state legislature and in Congress, to consider sentencing reform, for example. There is much less incentive to reform a system to reduce the prison population if those representatives also have prisons in their backyards, which they perceive are helping their communities economically. So you have, essentially it sets up a very bad reward system for the continuing expansion of prisons that really is divorced from any objective concern of criminal justice policy.
Sure.
If I could add to that.
Sure, Paul Layton.
Prisoners are also counted for purposes of the census in terms of where they spend their sentence and not where they came from. So if you are in prison when the census comes around, you're counted as a resident of a rural area. And that ends up altering financing for cities versus rural areas, the apportionment of representatives, and a whole host of other things that go along with it. At the same time, if you've been convicted of a crime, you usually lose your right to vote. So we find that people from the cities are kind of losing out in the census and losing out again when it comes time to vote and make their voice heard.
Is it possible to point to real consequences of those shifts?
People are doing that now because the total number of people who have been through prison and have lost the right to vote is up in the millions. Some of those folks wouldn't have voted anyways, which kind of muddies the water a little bit. So we're still not quite there with the smoking gun saying it would have made a difference in this election, but people are more and more aware that this is an issue.
And actually, if I could just add, there is a wonderful resource for your listeners on this question in particular of is it actually having an effect. There's a website called www.prisonersofthecensus.org, which is will give you essentially all the up-to-date research on this and facts of the week, which are absolutely fascinating.
Tracy Hewling is co-director of the National Resource Center on Prisons and Communities. She's also a filmmaker. She directed the documentary Yes, in My Backyard, which examines the prison industry in rural New York. We are talking today about economics and prisons, and we're going to take some phone calls a bit later in the program at 1-888-859-1800. 1-888-859-1800 is the number to call if you'd like to join in our conversation. Give us a call. We're also talking today with Paul Layton. He is a sociologist and a criminologist at Eastern Michigan University. He is the co-editor of the book Criminal Justice Ethics. Paul Layton, you mentioned before state spending and the high level of state spending on prisons, and I do want to talk about state fiscal policy and prisons. As people are probably well aware, a lot of states around the country are in real fiscal crisis. What sort of a chunk of a state's budget does corrections end up being?
I wouldn't have specifics on that. We know in general that that portion of state budgets has gone up quite dramatically as the number of prisons operates, the number of employees to support that has gone up. And in most states, it's gone up a lot faster than spending for public education, for community services, for crime prevention even. This has actually given us some interest groups that are now participating. A couple of guards unions, especially in California, have become very active in lobbying for more tough on crime so there are more prisons so they can further expand their base. And we have a lesser version of the same phenomenon going on elsewhere.
What about privatization? Tracy Hewling, when you were looking at prisons in rural economies, were you looking at private prisons or publicly funded institutions, publicly run institutions?
Well, we've looked at both. Essentially, from a community point of view, there isn't much difference in terms of the impact on the economy. Both from the wildly exaggerated benefits and from the point of view of things like inmate work crews, which do provide some benefit to the community. The issue in terms of private business versus a public entity coming into a community. What happens is that most communities in rural America, because they're in such bad shape, offer the moon to any industry, public or private, that wants to locate there. So, for example, what they do is the tax subsidies or the giveaways, we call them, are tremendous around private prisons. So whatever economic benefit the community might have gotten from choosing, let's say, a private prison over a public prison is usually a wash.
So what kinds of giveaways? I mean, in this context, what sorts of promises does a community make?
Tax abatements is the clear number one giveaway.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll say to a private prison company, you won't have to pay taxes in our community if you come and you stay here.
Mm-hmm. Paul Layton, what is your sense of the private prisons are supposed to be a solution to the problem of the cost of running prisons? Are they?
Not really. They're certainly billed that way, and they play on the ideology that government is inefficient and private business is much more efficient and less bureaucratic. All of the studies show that private prisons at best save about 1%. That was a recent National Institute of Justice study. They did say there could be a couple of other benefits in making the private sector a little bit more competitive, but certainly the claims like of the Corrections Corporation of America that they save 15 or 20% are kind of wildly overblown. The benefits to communities is even more problematic because if you start by giving them a tax abatement, then it takes longer before the tax money paid in actually has any benefit in terms of schools and services. We also know that companies give them subsidies for water hookups, sewer utilities, and lots of times try to float tax-free municipal bonds to help with the construction of a private prison. Corrections Corporation of America has also petitioned to be reclassified, not commercial, but residential. You know, hey, people live here, so we're actually a residential facility, and we should qualify for lower tax rates on that basis.
Interesting. We're talking today about economics and prisons. Our number is 1-888-859-1800, 1-888-859-1800. Again, the number is toll-free anywhere in the U.S. So if you would like to join in our conversation, if you have a question or a comment, give us a call. You are listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Tracy Huling, let's see if we can maybe summarize a little bit. So when a prison is going to be built in a community, let's say a rural community, give me a sense of the players here, the people who have an economic interest in that happening. How many different factions are there?
Well, typically what happens, let's take a state prison, for example, or even a federal facility. The main cast of prison boosters, if you will, are usually the local county commission or county legislature, the state representative, and in the case of a federal prison, a U.S. representative or senator. Those people are usually the people that are driving the train, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the economic development community in that particular community may be in favor of that prison and may not. Sometimes the chambers of commerce, which are the private, small private business owners in a rural community, can be in favor of a prison or not. We have actually found very, very mixed groups of people for and against, if you will.
Did this lobbying and the weighing of different interests or competing of different interests, did this happen before this boom in the 1970s? I mean, what, or I guess the construction boom didn't come until a bit later, but there were prisons before that. People built them. Is the economics of that construction different now or just bigger?
Definitely. It's very, very, it's a very different situation now. Essentially, what happened was in the 1980s, the economies of rural communities across America bottomed out for a variety of different reasons. Small farms went out of business. Manufacturing plants left the area and in some cases left the country. So you had an incredible loss of blue-collar jobs, essentially, jobs that you didn't need a whole lot of education for but paid family wages. There has been nothing to replace those jobs. And so you have rural communities across the country, which are dying, starving for any kind of job that will provide a decent wage and good benefits. A government industry like a prison, a public prison, is very attractive to people who are starving to death. To be quite frank, that's what's going on.
Were there prisons? We have to take a break in a minute, but I mean, where were the prisons before? Were they in rural communities, or were they somewhere? Is it new that they're being built here?
It's fairly new in the last 20 years.
And before they were in urban areas?
Urban and suburban areas.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll take some phone calls. Our number is 1-888-859-1800. 1-888-859-1800. Again, the number's toll-free anywhere in the U.S., so give us a call if you'd like to join in our conversation. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Welcome back to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. We've been talking today on the program about prisons and the economy, looking at some of the economic effects of the boom in prison construction that's taken place over the past two decades. Our guests for the conversation are Tracy Hewling. She's the co-director of the National Resource Center on Prisons and Communities. She's also a filmmaker. She made the documentary Yes in My Backyard, which examines the prison industry in rural New York. We're also talking with Paul Layton. He is a sociologist and a criminologist at Eastern Michigan University in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Paul Layton is the co-editor of the book Criminal Justice Ethics. Our number, once again, 1-888-859-1800. Let's take a call. Let's talk with Noel. Hello, Noel. You're on Odyssey.
Hi. It seems to me that the problem is an unskilled and uneducated workforce, not the prisons. And that blaming prisons for the unemployable is like blaming hospitals for sick people. Opening up the prisons and letting them out doesn't suggest what could be done. What evidence is there that crime prevention stops as much crime as removing people?
Paul Layton?
That's a good question. And I certainly don't want to be interpreted as blaming prisons on a lot of the economic problems we have with unemployment and the kind of jobs that we're creating. There's actually a good deal of evidence that crime prevention programs work, and they actually achieve phenomenal return on investments, because if you prevent someone from committing a crime, they become a legitimate, productive worker and a taxpayer. They contribute to the system. If they commit a crime, then it's $25,000 a year that's on our tab. There was recently a major evaluation done by Lawrence Sherman of a lot of crime prevention money that Congress had spent that kind of indicated a whole category of things that seemed to work well and look promising. There's a book by Elliot Curry called Crime and Punishment in America that does the same thing, especially looking at some of the early childhood intervention programs, things like Head Start, trying to prevent child abuse and neglect, mentoring, working with at-risk juveniles. All these things do have a track record. They don't cost a ton of money, and they pay for themselves quite well.
Tracy Hewling, any thoughts on this question?
Yes, I would agree that the return on investment for alternative to incarceration programs is very well documented. You know, the costs of incarcerating someone are fairly astronomical, particularly to the taxpayer, and the cost to the taxpayer of these alternatives, which again have been documented to reduce recidivism, whereas prisons are really not very good recidivism reducers. They are really crime generators. And as taxpayers, I think we should all be concerned about that.
All right, let's take another call. Let's talk with Amina. Hello, Amina, you're on Odyssey.
Hi. I was calling. I was hoping you could address the issue of the removal of secondary education from the prison systems and how this is affecting the communities that are receiving the reentry population. A lot of these communities are receiving people who are coming home with no work history, no education, and no ability to partake in voting or any other form of civic participation.
All right. Paul Layton, can I give that to you?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, and that's something that criminologists are really grappling with. It's interesting because back in the 30s, a couple of criminologists named Shaw and McKay studied Chicago and looking at patterns of crime. And they kind of identified some zones of transition that tended to be very high crime rate areas. Criminologists are now going back to that and finding that the number of people incarcerated tends to come disproportionately from certain inner city minority neighborhoods. So we kind of have coercive mobility out of there going to prison. We kind of brutalize people in prison, give them little work and little to show for their time there, and then stick them back into the community. And this actually erodes an awful lot of informal social controls, things like family, things like communities, churches, a whole host of other things that we know actually work to prevent crime.
Why does it erode them?
Just because you have kind of people being yanked from the community and going away, not necessarily having a lot of contact with their family while they are away because of the expenses. Things like collect telephone calls from prison are kind of a racket that states make money on at the expense of prisoners' families, but it's difficult to stay in touch with somebody. And then you're putting someone back who is probably worse for their experience in prison and doing that in large numbers and concentrated areas, such as what the caller seems to be talking to. There's little in prison to make people better. So when you kind of take that on top of pulling people out of the community and forcibly sticking them back in, you add an awful lot of upset and disorganization to the community.
Tracy Hewling, any thoughts?
Yes, actually, there's a criminologist by the name of Todd Clear who's done some very, very interesting work looking at the impacts of taking so many people out of particular communities. And one of the things that he has found is that once you reach essentially a critical mass of people that you have taken out of a community, and there's a continual recycling of those folks in and out of prison, that the community actually suffers an increase in crime. So on the one hand, you know, the intuitive response is, oh, good, you're taking all these troublemakers out of a community, but at some point you tip over that and you create a situation where you have a community that's more crime-ridden than you started with.
And this, again, I want to go back to the question of change, because you've both mentioned the magnitude of the change over the last two decades. To what extent are the phenomena that you're describing new as a result of the changes, and to what extent are they simply magnified by the increased size of the population that is circling or cycling through prisons? Paul Layton?
Yeah, it is magnified, but at some point, that becomes a qualitative difference. During the especially 1980s, when the prison population was really bursting at its seams and you had a lot of economic downturn in lots of areas, a lot of businesses started looking at that graph showing the incarceration rate and said, hey, this is an expanding market. You know, this isn't necessarily a bad thing. We can try to figure out how to make money on this. So incarceration became big business. Once you start to get private prisons involved, you bring in Wall Street, you bring in investment banks. So you end up with what's been called kind of a whole criminal justice commercial complex, kind of like the military industrial complex, but criminal justice and especially corrections instead. And you find that that is driving a lot of things rather than public safety and issues of justice.
Let's take another call. Let's talk with Noah. Hello, Noah, you're on Odyssey.
Hi. Hi. You're talking about the cost of a prison. What about the untold cost of prison? What about the untold cost of not incarcerating people in terms of more victims, more drugs being sold, and higher insurance rates as a result of the crimes that we could be committed by the people who are now incarcerated? What about that?
Paul Layton?
You know, I would agree that that is an issue, although, again, keep in mind that a lot of the people are there for petty crimes, and it's hard to quantify the impact of a drug offense. But if somebody has stolen $100 worth of stuff and you incarcerate them at $25,000 a year, there is some potential false savings there, especially if they come out more likely to brutalize in the future. I agree that there are some real issues of drugs, but sometimes drug treatment, especially drug treatment on demand, is much more cost-effective than incarceration, where drugs are still available. You know, you can get almost anything in prison. People make connections. They talk about what they did. They find out who to hook up with on the outside again and go back a bigger-time criminal than they went in.
We're talking today on the program about prisons and the economy. We're taking a look at the way that the expansion in prison construction and in incarceration rates has begun to generate economic forces of its own. You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Our number, 1-888-859-1800. Give us a call if you would like to join in our conversation. Tracy Hewling, in looking at prisons in different locations, do you ever find or have there been instances of prisons being closed down, and how does that work?
Yes, as a matter of fact, recently there have been several states that have moved to try and close prisons because the prison population has actually declined slightly. And that is a result also of the actual decrease in crime that we've experienced in the 1990s, although, as your previous caller pointed out, the perception of the average person is that crime is not going down, it's going up. That is not the case, and you know, people in leadership have to take responsibility for the messages that they're sending, because actually at the same time that we've had this prison expansion boom, we've experienced a decrease in crime.
But back to the question of closing a prison. I mean, does that have its own?
Yes. What happens is when you try and close a prison, and this is happening right now in the state of Ohio, a governor wants to close the governor of Ohio wants to close a prison that's no longer needed. However, the union, the correction officers union, and other forces that are obviously, you know, making money off the prison, have created, essentially sued the state, challenging the governor's right to close a prison. So what, and we're seeing this essentially all over the country, where governors are trying to close prisons, that there are interests, including rural communities, which are lobbying to keep the prisons open.
On what grounds would you say that a governor doesn't, how do you make a suit like that?
Well, in this case, there's issues of, you know, if you close the prison down, what will the effects be on the community, on overcrowding, on officer safety conditions in other prisons, on prisons, on prisoners themselves, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of issues that have been brought up in the lawsuit, but this is occurring all over the country. They're trying to close three prisons right now in California. And they're having, the new governor there is having a terrible time trying to close these prisons.
Paul Layton, what do you see in terms of the trends? Is the construction boom over?
It's certainly become a lot more difficult with state budget cuts. You know, this is something that's finally starting to seep down to the point where we're saying maybe we shouldn't build more, maybe we shouldn't commit more resources to prison, but it's taken an awful lot of budget cuts to get here. On the other hand, we still have an awful lot of the same interest groups in place. I mean, we still have a very powerful guards union in lots of these areas. We still have the private prisons that are lobbying aggressively for expansion. You have all the Wall Street investment firms who are still there, you know, kind of saying, hey, let us help you find different ways to finance this and issue bonds and do other things, because they take a cut of all of this bond floats that go out. So there's still a lot of interest there, but a few more people are starting to kind of say, hey, in a time of budget cuts, you know, we need to be cutting across the board. We can't cut education 10% in the state and give more money to prisons.
Well, I mean, what sort of grounds are those for making decisions about prisons?
They're probably not the ideal ones, but at this point, you know, we have so many people incarcerated at such great expense that any movement that way is a welcome sign if it's done intelligently in terms of keeping, diverting people out of prison who are the least threats to public safety. So that kind of needs to be the key next step. We really need to look, have an intelligent look at diversion programs and alternatives. And if we want to release anyone for having spent enough time in prison, making sure that they can safely go back to the community.
Paul Layton is a sociologist and criminologist at Eastern Michigan University in Ypsilanti, Michigan. He is the co-editor of the book Criminal Justice Ethics. Tracy Hewling, final thought from you on those grounds for, I heard you chuckle.
Well, I do want to say that I think one of the themes of the day, if you will, is if you build them, you will fill them. And in terms of how we look at prison expansion, that is essentially what is going on, that every cell that you add will be filled, because they are now, states across the country, even though they are trying different ways not to have to spend money, state money, at least on the books, on prison expansion, they are also passing new laws to put more people in prison. Across the country right now, for example, we're seeing the same kinds of hysteria that occurred in the 1980s around crack. We're now seeing it around methamphetamine use. And so the long arm of the criminal justice system is extending into now into the red areas of the map, if you will, into rural areas where they are putting more and more people into prison for long periods of time for usage of methamphetamine.
Tracy Hewling is co-director of the National Resource Center on Prisons and Communities. She is the director of the documentary Yes in My Backyard, which examines the prison industry in rural New York. Tracy Hewling and Paul Layton, thank you both very much for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks also to everyone for listening and for calling. Odyssey's theme music was composed and performed by OK Go. Thanks to our research assistant, Neil Verma, and to our interns, Maura Waltz and Kira Epstein. Our technical producer is Steve Warnauskas. Our program is produced by Allison Cuddy, Delia Lloyd, and Becky Vlamis. The senior producer of Odyssey is Joshua Andrews. Odyssey is a production of Chicago Public Radio under general manager Tori Malatia. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Join us again next time for Odyssey.
Funding for Odyssey is provided by generous grants from Doris Sasser, the Staines family, and the listeners of WBEZ Chicago, where Odyssey is produced. The views expressed are not necessarily those of Chicago Public Radio, this station, or its sponsors. To listen again, visit our website, odysseyradio.org. You can find information there on how to order a copy of the show. That's odysseyradio.org.